Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 193, Menla and the Buddha's Eightfold Path.
And I want to say one thing that I just have to say. I can never forget that the seat of enlightenment means Bodh Gaya. And our dear beloved Sharon, when she first went to India as a young girl seeking from going from Buffalo, I think?
I was in college in Buffalo.
To Bodh Gaya, India, to try to figure out what was going on in her mind. There she met a man who is very much unrecognized in the world, called Kuno Lama Rinpoche, who was an Indian citizen from Tibetan cultural extraction from the Himalayas within India, who had the special teaching of love and compassion from Shantideva and Manjushri, called the equal exchange of self and other, how to give up your self preoccupation and happily adopt other preoccupation or true altruism of the bodhisattva mind. And he gave to Sharon a seed of the Bodhi tree as the first thing almost that happened to her, I think, in India, according to the story. And I think, was that your faith book?
Yeah.
Faith book. And Sharon has made this seed so fruitful for the enlightenment of so many people. And she has been so kind to Menla, coming here year after year in this cold winter time of the Western New Year. And hopefully we'll continue to do so. And we are so appreciative and so thankful to you, Sharon.
Oh, thank you.
100%.
Thank you.
So thank you, Sharon.
Thank you.
I just want to say, and I dedicate the merit of that to everyone.
Thank you. Thank you for your
Brilliance.
Sharon. Yes, thank you for my doctorate. Thank you for your brilliance, and thank you for your efforts when you weren't feeling so well.
It's okay.
It's not that easy.
Actually, I feel fine, just my voice. But maybe that's good, because it isn't loud and it's irritating as it usually is. It's a little more croaky. So.
Really, thank
mute.
You.
It's like putting a mute in the trumpet.
We would be standing out in a field right now if it weren't for Bob and Nina.
And of course, Nina, yes, doctor. Talk to Nina. We have a nice warm room here. Thanks to Nina. Yes. Nina, I have to tell you all a story because we need everybody's help, of course. We want you all to help us here. We need it because this has to be a community. And actually, recently we had a shaman here, a lady from California, who is a great shaman, actually. And she contacted the guide who used to teach through the medium of Eva Parakas, who was the lady of the Center for the Living Force and the Pathwork Center, which was two communities ago that had this place, which was then given to us free. We could never have bought this place. It was given to us by positive karma, you know, by some protectors or something, by a kind, generous woman from New York. And the morning that the call came giving us this place, from this generous donor, just before our 60th birthdays. I woke up a little late. I was just back, I was jet lagged. I was back from Mount Kailash in India, in Tibet, rather. Should be India, but Tibet. And should be international, like all holy places, actually. And so I slept late, got up around 10 o'clock, jet lagged. And then I was already up. She was a little bit roiled up. because she'd been working hard with my our daughter to make a birthday party for me, a 60th birthday. So she said, "I had a terrible dream." And I said, "Well, what was that, dear?" She says, "Well, instead of enjoying our 60s relaxing and, you know, doing something pleasant here and there, we were working like dogs on some huge project. And you were climbing on the roof of a giant building. And you were hammering away, like, because I'm a carpenter. You were hammering and shouting at an architect. And worst of all, you weren't listening to me." "So, if anybody proposes any big project to you, say no." I said, "Yes, absolutely, dear, absolutely." This is why I think we received the gift in one phone call.
Right, it was like because, half an hour later, right?
Yeah, half an hour later, the phone rings. Then the phone rings and the donor is on the line and says, "Do you want the Pathwork Center in Phoenicia, which is 20 minutes from where we live in Woodstock, in Bearsville?" And I said, "Well, I know the place very well. I used to teach here, Book of the Dead and other things when it was owned by Pathwork Center. And, but, you know, and of course I need a thing like that." I said, "But I have to say no because my wife told me to say no about any big project." And I think she was so pleased that I was listening to my wife, or pretending to, that I think that's why she decided. So then I said, "But wait a minute." And she says, "Really?" "Yes." I said, "I have to say no." And then I said, "Wait a minute, let me ask her again." So then I asked her, and she said, "Oh, damn it. I can't say no because it will be an asset of the Tibetans. But I will have to work my ass off for a decade or two decades to make it function for nothing without a thank you," she said. "But say yes." So then I said yes. So then we made an appointment. So I wasn't even taking it seriously. I thought, because a lot of people say we're going to do this and that, and they didn't do it. And for Tibet, you know, because it's hard to do things for Tibet. It's the invisible lost cause, the invisible lost people, people who supposedly don't exist. They're just Chinese of some kind, blah, blah, blah. So it's very difficult. And so I forgot what I was going to say. Never mind. So, yeah, so this place is where Medicine Buddha, you know, creates his mandala to help Shakyamuni Buddha by showing people that they can live happily and healthily, and they don't have to be constantly the victims of a disease care industry, and they don't have to eat the bad food, and they don't have to think bad thoughts, and reality loves them, including the plants and the grass and the insects and the air, and even the malaria bug loves you. And the malaria loves me. It's great for me. I have malaria now. I know about what Somerset Maugham meant in the British Empire. And I have a malaria. That's wonderful. So this is the vision. But we cannot do this by ourselves. We're getting old. Sharon has helped us so much. And we need everyone's help. So please try to think of what can be done to make this, you know. And actually the vision I had, which brought this forth, was Menla's, not just here, but West Coast, and finally in Tibet itself, all of Tibet being a medicine land. You know? And His Holiness's vision, it's really not mine, it's His Holiness. 1981, he told me, if Tibet were free under whatever political arrangement, doesn't matter, but free on the land, on the ground, then we want to be like a Switzerland for the people of the world. But of course, nearby, the people of Asia, all these polluted cities, all these difficult places, they come up into high, clean mountain air. They go to wonderful hot springs. There are so many in Tibet, mineral healing springs. They have the wonderful herbal medicine that the Tibetans have. And they live here happily with the yaks and the people and the Tibetan monks and nuns and mendicants. They become healing specialists. We have sanatorias, like Switzerland of Asia. That's his vision. So this is rehearsing for where all of Tibet will be that for the world. And so Tibet needs your help. Menla needs your help. And you are helping, and thank you so much for helping by coming this one time and practicing the eight, carrying with you the eightfold path in your life and livelihood as you go forward from now on. It is really nice to be here. I think maybe we have to celebrate a little bit the place. You know, this valley is this amazing place that for the last 40 years or 50 years, it has been a center of people discovering themselves, actually. And then when the grandmothers came here, that's one of the wise women from the Native American people, I think from the Onondaga tribe, which is one of the six tribes, six nations of the Great White Tree of Peace, the Daganoweda, Iroquois Confederacy, I think it's called sometimes, all here in this area of New York State up into Canada, of the native people who are here, Algonquin, Iroquois, Mohawk, Tuscarora, Onondaga, Seneca, Mohawk, I think, whatever, I don't know how many that is. Anyway, she said that the spring that gives the water to this place, coming out from under what they call Panther Mountain, but I think someday in the future it will be called Menla Mountain, actually. Mountain of the healing enlightenment. And was always holy to the native people who never lived up here. They only came up here for retreats, for vision quests. They also exposed the dead on those high platforms, which was their way of dealing with the dead bodies, giving it back to the animals, you know, in nature. And they hunted and they gathered, you know, nuts and herbs and things. But they never lived in this. And this whole area was a primeval hemlock pine tree forest from here to Woodstock and all around in these areas. And then underneath this particular place where you have this circular stream over this meteor strike, great giant crater that used to be here, 400 million years ago, radiating some kind of magnetic something. It is really a place of great blessing. A treasure is here, you know. And then that's why there's a great dragon, serpent dragon, Naga here, that the Dalai Lama met when he came here. And the Dalai Lama said, actually, when he, you know, when I went to greet him, I think you heard the story, at the little snow lion house up here, which we fixed up specially to be his house. He said he had in the morning a big bowl of milk he was offering. Huge bowl, must have been a gallon and a half of milk in it. And I said, "What's that, Your Holiness?" He said he was offering to the Naga. He said, "You have one really big Naga here," he said, "very huge, powerful Naga." And I said, "Oh dear, Holiness, I hope it didn't disturb your sleep." He says, "No," he said, "I had the best sleep I ever had in North America," he said. And he's been everywhere in North America, actually. He's been really all over the world. And then he recommended a certain puja that we do, which involves offering milk to the underground, underwater, you know, Naga spirits, who actually are very disturbed in America nowadays by fracking, I think. Because fracking poisons the earth underneath in a very bad way, you know, putting the poison water back in and this kind of thing. So I think the Tibetans never even caught fish in the rivers because they thought it would displease the Nagas because the fish somehow represented these underwater beings. So they never ate fish, ever. Tibetans didn't. And the rivers were teeming with fish. Chinese went nuts when they got there catching the fish. So it's a great blessing to be here together in this wonderful sort of little hidden valley, what the Tibetans call a beyul, a hidden valley, like a Shangri-La Valley, you know, where you go into the valley and you're closed in from the world in a sort of emptiness womb of compassion. We should put that over a gatehouse if we ever build a gatehouse. I think we will. Maybe in English too. So funnily, what's coming in my mind about carrying on, you know, keeping alive the retreat, calm and peacefulness and happiness, and compassion toward others in the, you know, when you're not on the retreat. What always comes back to me is the Eightfold Path, you know, the Fourth Noble Truth. But then there's the issue of Buddhism, and I want to also mention that there's another element about the place now. I think somehow it is encased in His Holiness the Dalai Lama's consciousness. And sort of this is his retreat place in America, like Tibet House is his cultural center in America. Nina and I sometimes get tired of managing it, and we're in our mid-70s now. Nina will be 75 on Friday, and I'll be 75 a few months later. And sometimes we whine to His Holiness and we say, wouldn't somebody else like to take care of Tibet House? And Menlon, he says, no, you have to keep working. He says, he never lets us off the hook. So somehow we're in his hands, you know, here in a way. His presence is kind of here. He was teaching this time in South India, and I had letters from people, and he was very much glowing, and he was very, very happy. And he gave a lot of talks to people, thanking them for coming, similar like to what we're doing this morning. It's interesting. But the one key thing is he never wants people to be Buddhists. Even he wants you to know about Eightfold Path of development, Eightfold Path to freedom, to nirvana, to happiness, to freedom from suffering. But you don't need to be Buddhist to do that. He's against making people Buddhist. And he also has spoken to the leaders of all the other world religions, various popes, archbishops of Canterbury, Protestant ministers, Hindu swamis, Muslim, you know, mullahs and imams and people. And he's asked them, he particularly likes the Jewish people because they don't try to convert people. Unless you marry into a Jewish family or something, they have a little fuss about it. Orthodox people do. But otherwise, they don't try. And he thinks that's very important at this time of history, that people encourage followers of other traditions, including secular humanism, which he considers a world religion, which I am a little bit, about the nihilistic view, I'm a little more critical than he is. But he tells me to shut up when I get into it anyway. So he considers that a world religion. And he feels that it's a time of pluralism in every city, in every country in the world. And there's people from every tradition. And therefore, you cannot have religious institutions competing for market share. You know. So he feels this is not a good time. The time in history is past. And that's actually a really good sign that he says that, because actually in the prophecy of Shambhala, when Shambhala comes on earth, which is the Buddhist sort of post-Armageddon New Jerusalem idea, you know, from Kalachakra Tantra, one of the phenomena is that all the world religions get along and they don't compete each other. And they see that it's possible through whatever path for people to reach freedom of some sort. You know, like nirvana, you don't have to have a special membership card to reach nirvana. You know, you can be a Jew Boo, Chris Boo. I mean, you can even be just a Jew or a Muslim or whatever. You don't have to be a Boo at all. Forget about the Boo. But maybe the Eightfold Path as the core of a kind of curriculum remains important, actually. And there can be an Eightfold Path in connection with any tradition, although theologically or philosophically, that may involve some critical thinking. You know, for example, no one, as His Holiness says, he recently said, actually in an interview I did, he said, He never says Buddhism is the best for everyone. For himself, he thinks it's the best. And that's, people are allowed to do that about their own tradition. But he never says it's the best for everyone. On the other hand, as a science, you know, what is the nature of the psyche? You know, what is the nature of the atom? What is the nature of the environment? What is the nature of the cosmos? There can be arguments about that. And he's quick to reject the old Indian cosmology that Buddha didn't contradict in his time about Mount Meru, you know, the axial planetary axis was a mountain and the different continents stuck off in flat. It isn't that the Earth was flat. It's that the continents, like Eurasia, was a flat petal that stuck off the mountain. But the mountain was a big lump like this with sun and moon, you know, that would go around it and so on, the stars. But it was terracentric. So he loves to say how he disagrees with that. And he's brave enough to disagree with Buddha, catering to the local Indian science. So in science, there is a kind of, in dealing with reality, there is a right and wrong. And there has to be critical analysis. And there has to be competition of thought and reasoning. In reason, there has to be. And he is an advocate of reason. So in a way, there is a way of converting people to be reasonable, you know, within conventional parameters of reason. I mean, reason is not ultimate. It's about the relative, but still, there is a reasonable thing. So let's go over, just summarize, since you know what it is, the Eightfold Path. To carry with you the Eightfold Path. Sharon is encouraging you 9 minutes and 7 minutes to change your brain. And that's very correct and very good. And that's the seventh branch of the Eightfold Path, the mindfulness branch. And then the loving kindness comes as a, really from the, some of the earlier branches. So let me summarize them. Let's think through them together. The first branch of the Eightfold Path, best translation of it, is realistic worldview. And its opposite is unrealistic worldview. So this beginning of one's practice, and all of it is all of the Eightfold Path is practice, or as I prefer to call it, performance. I'm tired of practice. I like people to perform. I myself have been practicing a lot, and I'm still useless and hopeless. And luckily, my kind wife is kind enough to continue to try to correct me, and I've made a little progress. But I still need to perform, actually, not just to practice. So the first performance is to correct any unrealistic element in one's worldview. And here, this doesn't mean believing in God or believing in Buddha or believing in this or that or not believing in it. In a way, it's like belief, but it isn't really belief. It's a worldview. It's how you look at the world, how you kind of reasonably decide and realistically decide to look at the world. And the key thing that requires a kind of acknowledgement or acceptance, or you could say belief, you know, but it's really how you view things, is a belief in causation. Isn't that surprising? Buddha's great only demand on people in the sense of being reasonable was to urge them, as the beginning of their practice, to accept, to acknowledge, to be aware of causation. So his great celebratory verse about his teaching is Om ye dharma hetu prabhava hetun tisham tathagata hiyavadat tisham chayo nirudho vambadi mahasramani swaha. So of all things that arise from causes, what are the causes and how they are terminated or ceased? This is the teaching of the great seeker, Mahasramana, the great wanderer, the great seeker. His famous verse.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallahs. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This episode was originally recorded at the annual Tibet House US Dharma and Yoga Retreat with Sharon Salzberg, Robert Thurman, Carolyn Christie, and friends. This annual program happens in the heart of the Catskills at Tibet House's Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa, located just 2 hours north of New York City. To learn more about this annual program, look in the podcast description or visit menla.us. As we heard in the first half of this week's episode, Professor Thurman dedicated the merit of the teaching to the work of Sharon Salzberg and included some great early stories of her first visit to India and the early history of Menla Retreat and its previous history as a pathwork center. If this week's episode inspires you, be sure to join us this New Year's Eve at Menla. And be sure to visit the podcast description. We'll link to several past episodes, which include archive recordings from this great program. Stay tuned. Later this month, we'll post a podcast extra, which will include the extended full audio from this program. For shorter episodes, look in the podcast description. We have some early episodes on other parts from this program, including a great one on emptiness and another on exchange of self and other. The second half of this week's episode is a detailed teaching on the Buddha's Eightfold Path. Hold on to your seats. It's one of the best presentations I've heard of Professor Thurman's Eightfold Path. It's for Buddhists and non-Buddhists alike. We hope you enjoy this week's episode. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special trips with Professor Thurman and geographic expeditions, please visit tibethouse.us. Your monthly support and online participation helps support Tibet House's mission of presenting and preserving Tibetan culture. Membership begins at $2 a month, and your online donations help make our work possible. Music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is generously supplied by Tenzing Chogyal, who also will be performing at this year's Carnegie Hall concert with Philip Glass and Friends. To learn more about this annual benefit with Philip Glass and Friends, please visit tibethouse.us. And now, back to Bob and the second half of this week's episode, which includes a reading of Emily Dickinson's poetry by Gary Gock.
Realistic worldview about causation automatically helps you to correct that feeling of yourself as this absolute thing. Do you follow me? Which is the very first step in practice or performance. It's the medicine. You know, it's the contradiction to that kind of thing that people say when they're losing their temper. And you say, well, come on, why do you have to blow your stack now or something? And then they say, because that's just the way I am. And that's where they bump into this unrealistic thing that there's something there that's just a fixed thing a certain way. And of course, when they're on, the upside of the manic cycle of the unenlightened psychotic, then they, that's an absolute thing. It's like whatever. And when on the downside, then they're deeply depressed because they think that unchanging fixed thing is something unworthy, something awful, something whatever, you know, all the put downs they've ever received in this life and previous lives. And also acceptance of causation means there cannot be any first cause. Things, every cause is itself the effect of something preceding it, which then opens up one's horizon to the beginninglessness, the infinity. So for example, if one is a theist, it opens one to the infinity of God. You can't say that God just sort of at one point out of nothing made something, because God was the something that he made it out of, who's infinite. So it involves maybe reinterpreting. Similarly, Big Bang for the materialist cannot be out of nothing. It's out of previous Big Crunch. So there's beginninglessness becomes a way in which one's connection to those things opens up once one adopts and accepts the realistic worldview that all is relative, all is causal, all is causation. Okay? But then there's an element of what is uncaused, not caused, which then also is beginningless. Also is infinite nirvana, but let's not push that right now. Main thing is because we're in the relative world, we're dealing with life, and we open our mind to causality. And this gives great combination of great freedom and great responsibility. With the great freedom comes the fact that there's no fixed way of being. So we can never be that bad, and we don't have to be that good. We can always just baby step. We can baby step it. Like one of the things I assigned as homework, which is to watch the movie, What About Bob? Which has nothing to do with me. It's the teaching of Bill Murray and Richard Dreyfuss. If you haven't seen it, you should rent it and see it. One is always doing something bit by bit. One is cultivating, realizing, developing positively bit by bit, or one is going down the drain bit by bit. So one can catch hold at any point. So that's the freedom. And then the responsibility is that if you don't catch hold of your causal process, of your constantly changing relative selfhood, apart from any fantasized absolute self, then yourself will be changed automatically by circumstance. And it will go where you haven't actually planned to go. But that's the first step. Then the second step of the Eightfold Path is called realistic motivation. Sometimes intention, people like to translate. But like motivation. So realistic motivation, once you have adopted causality and you realize you're a causal process, once you have adopted that, then your motivation is that you should associate yourself with all good causes. And you should reduce the connection to negative causes. And you are an evolving being, and you should develop the motivation to use your time of being conscious and having your will of choosing, your free choice, to whatever extent you have it, by however aware you are, so that you're motivated always to choose the positive, even if it's the tiniest little thing. And your motivation is to always choose the slight increment that's better as opposed to the increment that's worse, or just let it go without noticing. So then the third step is realistic evolutionary action. Kamanta. Samyak Kamanta. And action has three levels: physical, verbal, and mental. And realistic actions are not to harm or take life, not to kill, harm, or take life. Not to take what is not given to you, but to give whatever you can. to save life. You know, there's always one, a negative side and a positive side. Anything in the direction of saving life is realistic because it connects you with the larger life. You identify with more life when you save it. When you take it, you narrow, you say that life is not connected to me. I can take it away from that other person. And then with sexual contact, you never harmful in the sexual area and always beneficial and caring. And then that can be identified in different cultures, different ways. So those are the three physical. And always what's realistic about them is that they tend to expand your sense of life rather than contract it, so that you broaden your feeling of you live in other people as well as in other beings as well as in yourself. And unrealistic is where you narrow down and say, I don't have anything to do with these other people. Then there are four verbal. Tell the truth and not to tell a lie. To speak reconcilingly, making other people friendly with each other and making peace between other people, or causing dissension among them and slandering them to get them turned against each other. That's unrealistic. Speaking pleasantly or speaking harshly. Harshly is unrealistic, it drives people away. Pleasantly is attracts people and embraces them, and that's realistic. And finally, speaking meaningfully, which means trying to give others better understanding and insight and happiness and pleasure through speech, or just blabbing mindlessly without knowing what you're talking about, frivolously and foolishly, without any meaninglessly. Those are four of speech. And again, the realism and unrealism has to do with how much you embrace and enfold the other being. And then, and this is then where meditation comes in, of course, already in ethics. You can be unethical and you can have negative evolutionary action through your mind. And it's sort of parallel to the physical. You can be malicious and hateful. Even you're looking, smiling, and nice, you're thinking negative thoughts about someone. Or you're having loving thoughts about them. And these powerfully interact with others, actually. So you, even though you're not saying anything bad, you're not physically doing anything bad, if you're mentally thinking bad, it's bad evolutionary action. And even that's considered more powerful than the physical or the verbal, because it motivates the physical and the verbal. And it also communicates directly through morphic resonance. So the three negative, unrealistic evolutionary actions of mind are hateful mind, greedy mind, and unrealistic mind. Then following unrealistic action, evolutionary action, comes realistic speech, which is in a way also included there, but it's emphasizing the importance of speech, that's all. So I don't need to repeat what it is. And then realistic livelihood. So don't think that your livelihood is not related to your practice and your performance. It is. It doesn't mean you have to quit your livelihood, although people became mendicants in cultures that supported that, because all livelihoods have some little bit destructive. Even if you're a vegetarian and you have a garden, you're killing insects by plowing and planting and weeding and so on. And so that's why the Jains, for example, never could do agriculture. So whatever it is, the livelihood should follow the evolutionary action realistic path and should try to be minimize harm and maximize benefit. And realizing that, Buddha actually liked business. He liked merchants. He was a warrior class person, but he preferred merchants because merchants seek wealth and they seek prosperity by exchange, by interaction with others. So they are social. It's a more social way of gaining wealth, and it gives something to the customer. If they're going to be a satisfied customer, they have to get something good that you create, and then they give you back what they created. The military way of gaining wealth, it seems to be really great because you get everything from the customer in one shot. But the problem is you kill your customer, So then you can't sell them anything next year because they're dead. The mutual exchange and the increase of wealth by having both sides gain something, Buddha preferred, and in the history of Buddhism, it spread wherever merchant classes could spread their knowledge, actually, and spread that exchange. And in countries where the government controlled too much the merchant classes, it had difficulties. Now, number six, then, is realistic effort. It's usually translated, or diligence, some people say. But it has a definition where it means diligence in the good. It doesn't. Someone can be an energetic murderer, or bank robber, or hedge fund manager, or banker robber, or whatever, and that's not considered realistic. So realistic, that's why I like to translate it sometimes, is creativity, creative effort, always making something better out of whatever it is, yourself and anything you touch or anything around you. And so the first two are connected to wisdom, the next three are connected to ethics, and the sixth one is connected to all of them, realistic, creative effort in the good. And then number seven, I don't need to elaborate because it's Sharon's special expertise and mastery, and it is realistic mindfulness, which literally is the word memory, actually, smriti, sati. It literally means to remember. And that's crucial to know, realize that. And in a way, it's taking your memory, and instead of wandering in your sort of remembrance of past misdeeds and sufferings, it's remembering the present moment of what's going on right now. And instead of wandering into future fantasies and being mindful of those, you're mindful of the present, what's happening in your being, in your mind, and your activity right now. So that's a very important beginning of deepening your sort of mental realism about what you are and what your inner world, your inner processes, and gaining freedom in your inner processes rather than being driven by the unconscious. And this is the huge difference of Buddhist psychology, not a religious difference, a scientific one, and Western psychology. Because Buddhist psychology does not accept that you have to be unconscious and that you're going to be driven forever by a big sort of clump of unconsciousness. And realistic mindfulness, therefore, is a humongous enterprise of going so deep into yourself that there's nothing unconscious driving you, but you can find and discover all of the things down there, and you can consciously sublimate them toward the good, every energy. So there's no energy that would be negative if it was driven by unconscious and controlled by ignorance, covered over by ignorance, therefore, could ever make you do anything harmful or cause you any harm. And then finally, the eighth branch, this then leads, when you get totally conscious of everything, you then develop total concentration, you know, realistic samadhi, realistic concentrative realization. And that means complete one-pointed fluency, pliability or pliancy, whatever you like to call it, carried to extreme, total degree of inconceivability, total enlightenment. And so that means that you really can, for example, when anger wants to arise reactively because of some stimulus that you're reacting to, then you're aware of all that mechanism in the unconscious, whatever it is karmically. Somebody does something to you, and then you're unconscious in some past life, they did something. So you then react with fear and defensiveness and fury and so forth, and then there's a terrible situation. But that can't happen because you're so mindful. The mechanism of that, and also you completely see through the false memory, the memory having been mistakenly done in past, previous, many times, and you realize that it's all bliss anyway, and nothing can disturb your bliss. Blissful. It's just everything that happens is just a reflection in the mirror of what they call bliss void indivisible, or bliss freedom indivisible. So that's it. You got the Eightfold Path now? And realistic is so good. There's old translations of right versus wrong is bringing it into the Western authoritarian thing. Oh, there's a bunch of rules. You have to be right, not wrong. No, that's not. It's you have to, what is right is what accords with reality. Because reality loves you, and if more you accord with it, the better you are. Ignorance is not bliss. Ignorance is the cause of suffering. Wisdom is bliss. Knowing what's there, you fit in with what the reality loves you. So there are infinite Buddhas loving you. Absolutely everywhere. They're in every atom. They're everywhere. And all you have to, the more realistic you are, the happier you are. You know, the more fluent, the more pliant, the more pliable, the more fluent, the more flowing you are. Okay? Then, I'm going to do a meditation of a prayer, a dedication prayer. We'll close with. You go in meditative mode and repeat line by line as I read the first. To encourage you, the first 20 or so verses of this prayer, which is called the prayer or the vow. Okay? So please repeat after me line by line in a quiet, meditative voice. Okay? He traveled and contemplated in a land for an aeon, in another for up to as many as aeons as atoms in untold Buddha lands, without moving from that land. In each moment of consciousness, he entered infinite oceans of lands and developed sentient beings towards supreme perfect enlightenment. This continued as he gradually attained equality with universally good, Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, that is, in terms of the ocean of vows of practice of the universally good enlightening beings, equality with all Buddhas, equality of pervasion of all lands, equality of fulfillment of practices, equality of manifestation of the miracle of attainment of enlightenment, equality of voice and articulation, equality of power and expertise, equality of the enlightened state, equality of universal love and compassion, equality of the spiritual metamorphoses of the inconceivable liberation of enlightening beings. Then the great enlightening being, universally good, thus explaining courses of aeons, as many aeons as atoms in the untold Buddha lands in the succession of worlds, went on to make a vow or a prayer or a dedication. Okay, just to give you a kind of setting. Now repeat by line by line. As many Buddhas as there may be in the world, throughout the 10 directions, throughout past, present, and future, I honor them all without exception, pure in body, speech, and mind, with as many bodies as atoms in all lands, I bow to all those Buddhas. With a mind directed to all Buddhas, by the power of the vow of the practice of good, in a single atom, Buddhas as many as atoms, sit in the midst of enlightening beings. So it is of all things in the cosmos. I realize all are filled with Buddhas. I laud all the Buddhas therein, expounding in all languages the qualities of all Buddhas with endless oceans of manifestations, with the finest flowers, garlands, musical instruments, perfumes, and parasols, the finest lamps and incenses, I make offerings to those Buddhas. With the finest clothes, fragrances, and mountainous baskets of aromatic powders, with the finest of all kinds of adornments. I make offerings to those Buddhas. Whatever be the best of offerings, I produce them for all Buddhas by the power of devotion to the practice of good. I honor and serve all Buddhas. Whatever evil I may commit or have committed, under the sway of passion, hatred, or folly, bodily, verbally, or mentally, I confess it all. And whatever the virtues of beings everywhere, hearers, saints, self-conquerors, enlightening beings and Buddhas, in all that I do rejoice. And all the lamps of the worlds in the 10 directions, who have realized enlightenment and attained non-obstruction, I seek as guides that they may turn the supreme wheel of teaching. And those who wish to manifest extinction, I petition respectfully to remain for aeons as many as atoms in the land for the welfare and happiness of all beings. By honor, service, and direction, by appreciating, seeking, and requesting exchange, I'm sorry, by appreciating, seeking, and requesting teachings, whatever good I have accumulated, I dedicate it all to enlightenment. May the Buddhas of the past be honored, as well as those now in the worlds of the 10 directions. And may those of the future be at ease, filled with joy, having realized enlightenment. May all the lands of the 10 directions be purified, supreme, and filled with Buddhas and enlightening beings at the Tree of Enlightenment. May all beings in the 10 directions be happy and well. May all beings' righteous aim be successful. May their hope be realized. As I am carrying out enlightenment practice, may I recall my lives in all states, in every lifetime as I die and am reborn. May I always transcend the mundane, learning from all Buddhas, fulfilling the practice of good. I will practice pure conduct, always free from defect. And now this verse I am reciting in honor of Lin Ha as a way of penance for my misunderstanding her question. I will expound the teaching in the languages of gods and dragons, in the languages of demons and humans, and of all living beings. Okay, now finally, by honor, service, and direction, by appreciating, seeking, and requesting teachings, whatever good I have accumulated on this retreat here at Menla, I dedicate to enlightenment for all.
Emily Dickinson, who lived from 1830 to 1886, born into one of the prominent families of Amherst, Massachusetts. She was educated at Amherst Academy and attended Mount Holyoke Female Seminary for a year. During that time, an evangelical religious revival was sweeping the country. When the principal asked all those who wanted to be a Christian to rise from their seats, Emily was the only student who did not stand.
I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering firm for that last onset when the king be witnessed in the room. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portions of me be assignable, and then it was there interposed a fly with blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me. And then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see.
I'm Gary Gock, and this segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House, U.S., Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa, under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.